Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hi there, Ali from Empire here. This is just a quick intro to let you know that you're listening to yet another special Empire podcast. Following on in the audio footsteps of a Terrence Stamp spectacular comes this special 40 or so minute long Mike Newell podcast, taken from the time when he came in to talk about the re-release of his favourite movie ever, La Grande Illusion. Apologies to all French people who heard that and just spat. Anyway, as you might expect from a special Mike Newell podcast, we talk a lot about Mike Newell's work, including Donnie Brasco, Four Weddings and a Funeral, as well as his work with Jerry Bruckheimer on Prince of Persia. And perhaps, as you might not have expected, Johnny Depp's love of farting. So, without any further ado, take it away Chris Hewitt, Phil Desemelin, and, of course, Mike Newell himself.
But moving on to yourself at the moment, Mike, I mean, because you are in post on Great Expectations.
Yes.
How's it going?
It's going very well. It's going... I like it, but that's not always the case. Sometimes you make films you really don't like, and you look at it and you think, if only, if only, if only, if only. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any abiding regrets, particularly?
What about shows I've done?
Films that you've made.
Sure. Yes. Bad judgments. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have done that. Yes. Absolutely.
And they live with you. You sort of carry them around, or do you let them go? Because I guess having come from a television background, there must be an element of...
What, easy come, easy go?
Well, no, not that so much, but just, you know, getting into a pattern of finishing, moving to the next, and...
Well, I think that's... I mean, this may well be... The delicacy of your suggestion takes my breath away. I mean, if there's one big thing wrong with me, that's it. It is that I have terrible itchy feet. And... You know, you asked me whether I could. What did La Grande Illusion teach me? Mm. Well, that plus reading English at university taught me that there are standards in scripts, in stories, and how they're put together that you had better pay real attention to.
Yes.
And you could tell. You could tell Grande Illusion. From a much less complicated point of view, and out would come The Great Escape.
Yes.
And so, you know, you do begin to know where those boundaries lie. And I made an absolutely catastrophic film of Love in the Time of Cholera, the Marquez novel. And I don't know whether I did. I mean, it was worse reviewed than I have ever had. I phoned my American agent on the day that it was released, and in a sort of gallows humor mood, said, "All right, go on, tell me, how bad are they?" And he said, "Oh, you want to know? Right," he said, I have just been to my front door, 8-hour time difference, and I have picked up the Los Angeles Times, and here we have the review on the front page of the calendar section, the arts and leisure section.
Yes.
He said, "You're going to enjoy this," and he read it out. And it was excoriating. It was dreadful. And so what you'd say about that is that I loved that book. I absolutely loved the book, and one of the reasons that I made the movie, and it was a very, very injudicious choice, was that I loved the book so much.
Yeah.
And in a way, no movie could contain the book. Certainly my movie couldn't contain the book. I am not clever enough. And, you know, you do advance to the point where you fall off the cliff. It's an inevitable human progress. Yeah. And so the danger with the good thing about television is that it does set in you the itch to work. And the bad thing about television is that you don't ask hard enough, work on what?
Right. Yes.
I was very lucky because I started in TV in the great days of Granada TV and the BBC, and so they had this very, very high quality drama output. And it's not that you went to learn. You didn't. You went to work. But the work sorted people out. The people who did not have that kind of nose for the pure air at the top of the atmosphere found their own level. Mm. They made series and very fine, and so did I. Mm. But then you kind of moved up until you thought, hey, that's a good one. That's a, you know, that's a really good one. And you can see them.
Yeah.
And the good thing about TV for me was that it taught me to read scripts. Tons of scripts. That led to knowing what you did like and what you didn't like, what you did want to do and what you didn't want to do. But TV is dangerous. It's completely different now. It's not the same at all. But then what we were doing, the joke always was the British film industry is alive and well and living in Shepherd's Bush. and that's, you know, in a lot of ways, that's true.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it didn't quite make its Michael Haneke. there wasn't one great dominant. I mean, you could say Ken. Whatchamacallit?
Ken Loach.
Ken Loach. But that's not quite.
Is he our genre noir?
No. He. No. There isn't another one. He's a wonderful director, Loach. He's absolutely wonderful, and in terms of his spread. You know, he's brilliant at comedy. I thought Looking for Eric was a fabulous movie. Mm-hmm. And he's full of conviction and so on and so forth. But I don't know, maybe it's simply that we kind of idealize and romanticize the French, whereas it's not possible to romanticize ourselves in quite the same way.
Indeed,
yeah.
Indeed. You said that Love in the Time of Cholera was catastrophic for you and an injudicious choice.
It got very, very bad reviews, and so therefore.
But how do you feel about it as a film yourself? I mean, did you think this is a bad choice?
No, what I thought was it wasn't the happiest of films either. There were people on it whom I loved. I loved the cameraman, I loved the composer, I loved the English writer. But. It's so, I mean, it's about a guy who falls in love when he's 17 and he doesn't ever fall out of love. It's simply that he has an enormous number of women between the 17 and the age of 67 or 70 when finally the woman whom he loves, husband, dies. Yes. And he can, and so you have love and sex between old people. God bless the Americans. We had a preview in some godforsaken place in Southern California, and there was a scene which I knew was a terrific scene because I'd sat in, this is the preview process where you sit with an absolutely bog standard audience and you watch them and you feel them and it tells you things about the movie. It's very often very humiliating. And I'd seen 50, 60-year-old men cry at that point because, of course, everybody has one of those calf loves which they hang on to and which they fantasize will one day come good. And there were these ordinary middle-class Americans around me crying because they could see the leading character was in that situation.
Yes.
But down the front on the left hand side, see how well I remember it, was some 17 year old little shit who simply saw old people at it.
Yes.
And he very, very loudly went, And of course, he breaks the whole thing up. 300 people titter or roar or whatever it is. And the trouble with the movie is that it it had ambitions beyond its scope, and ambitions that really belonged only in a novel, and certainly ambitions beyond the talent of its director.
Oh, okay. You think you would say that yourself?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Is that something that becomes apparent to you
all the time
in post?
All the time. Yeah. No, sometimes during shooting.
Okay.
Sometimes during shooting, I can remember being in rushes on Harry Potter. I'm not claiming anything, but it was a good Harry Potter. Looking at this thing and thinking, and then realizing in a way to my horror that I was actually out of my seat in front of a full theater. That means 30, 40 people who are people working on the film, the makeup people, the props people, the designers, all of that kind of stuff, that I had actually got up and was down the front shouting at my lack of talent.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my word.
Everybody remembers it. People still come up to me and say, how are you feeling?
Give a hug, Mike. It's a really good film, Mike. You remember which scene?
Yeah, it is a really good film. I'm very proud.
Was it just one shot in particular you were unhappy with?
It was one sequence that I had this wonderful idea. And I'd got it. I'd just done it really badly. Mm-hmm. And this sweet man, Peter MacDonald, who was the second unit director, came up to me and said, look, he said, it'll be, don't worry. He's sort of stroking me. It'll be all right. Just put it on a different lens and look at it from this side and not from that side. And then get it to go a bit quicker and it'll all be all right. It's really nice to me. But it was a bad moment. Yes, that happens all the time. You look at it and you think, you're not good enough for that.
Oh, I have that all the time.
Right. Don't we all?
And people agree with me constantly. So,
yes,
which is even worse.
Right.
But what can you do?
That is so true. Flipping it over, did you have a feeling on, say, Four Weddings that you were really onto something?
No. I had a little feeling that I was onto a really, really good actor. And that was Hugh. Mm. And Hugh was... he had a career, but he didn't have the kind of stellar thing. And we'd been going to make Four Weddings a year before that, and we couldn't cast it. And we found this guy, Hugh, who wasn't available, who was going off to Australia to make a film with John Dygan. And so he wasn't available. Mm. And I said, we should put this off. We should stop now. We haven't got the money yet anyway. There's money hassle. But we should stop right now, and we should only go when this specific guy is available. And he had this extraordinary quality that what nobody realizes about that movie is that the powerhouse is the words. Mm. Is Richard's words, and the precision with which the jokes and the characters and the tragedies as well. I mean, the wonderful thing about the movie is that it's got this very, very steep graph to it. And the only one of the actors whom I met with, which is extraordinary because these are English actors and they're brought up on the word, who could really say this stuff was Hugh. And there's a scene at the end of the movie where, oh God, he hasn't got married. It's this wonderful moment where the deaf guy raps on the pew and everybody turns around and says, what's going on? And it's somebody objecting to the marriage. I was a choir boy, and there's always that wonderful moment in a wedding where the priest stands up and says, if any here have any let or cause and hindrance then why these two should not be joined together in holy matter, let them speak now or forever after hold their peace. And we all thought, go on, do it, there must be somebody out there. And it comes true in Four Weddings. But he then goes home unmarried.
Yes. Yes.
And there's a rainstorm outside, and then the doorbell goes and there she is. There's the girl that he should have married. And 'cause we had the fire brigade. So the rain is, because that's the only way that water shows on film. It's got to come down in chunks, so you don't see it. And they were both of them soaked within half a second. And the rain, of course, is hammering on the microphones. So you can't really hear anything. And so it all has to be done again in an absolutely dead atmosphere like this.
Okay.
And it's the final speech of the film. And I thought, it's asking too much. He's never going to be able to do it. But he came in and he did it in three takes because what he does and what nobody knows about Hugh, you look at him and you think, well, there's a gadfly if ever I saw one.
Yes.
But he's not. He's immensely hardworking. And that speech was rehearsed for the shooting absolutely down to the nanosecond. And it was in his head, so that when he came back in to do it, all he did was to call up that version of it, and he could do it perfectly. And he's sort of brilliant in that way. And you don't think that about him. You think, oh, he's the perennial slightly toffee boyfriend and that kind of stuff. He's a brilliant actor, absolutely brilliant.
But he's extraordinarily self-deprecating, because I interviewed him recently for The Pirates, his new movie. And
the voices are very good.
He's fantastic. He's really good, really good in it. And he was saying that at one point I was doing a voice for this and I thought I'd just have to turn up and speak, but I actually found myself having to act, which I don't like doing at the best of times, and I almost injured myself. And he's very, very self-deprecating, but there is a great actor under there.
Yes, under that. That's absolutely par for the course for Hugh.
Yeah.
Oh Lord, am I going to have to act? no, that's not true.
What was your immediate reaction when you imagine page one of the Four Weddings script has the word fuck on it quite a lot?
Absolutely wonderful.
Most directors wouldn't have got past it, I imagine.
Oh, rubbish. Of course they would. What was marvellous was that, to start with, the first time it was ever screened in public was at the Sundance Film Festival in good old Mormon
Utah. Yeah, I did.
And half the audience walked out. Horrible, horrible thing. Here's a first screening of your movie and half the audience leaves within the first minute and a half.
Indeed.
But then there was a wonderful thing where I was back in London checking prints or soundtracks or something like that. And we went to a cinema, little private cinema, to do this check. And my daughter, who was at that stage, she was about eight, nine, and she had a very zippy, funny au pair girl called Charlie. And I said, look, Charlie, they can come, because I can't, I haven't got time to do anything else with them. And you sit down the front, and there are about eight of these little girls, all the same age. But there are, at the beginning of the film, there are actually 14 fucks. I don't want the girls to have their ears sullied by that. So I want them to put their... And so the film started, and there were always a little row of heads sitting on the front. And I realised the first one came up, and Charlie, the au pair, stuck her fist up in the air and went, one! And by the end of it, all these little girls were going, seven! Eight!
Just as though they didn't watch Donnie Brasco.
I'm very proud of Donnie Brasco.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before Weddings blew up, so many careers. Obviously, John Hannah, and yourself. Did Donnie Brasco come about as a direct result of that? And again, that was...
It must have in some way or another, because that's how America is. That's how Hollywood is. I mean, it doesn't really matter what it is. If it tips over a kind of magic figure, then the world is your oyster. And of course, Hollywood thought I could do anything.
Mm.
And it then took them about three movies to prove that I couldn't. And gradually your stock in trade sort of, you come back down to earth. You come back to what you should be doing.
Mike, I think you're being very modest. I mean, Donnie Brasco is a great film.
That is how it works.
But you made Prince of Persia.
Yes.
So your stock must be pretty high if you're on Jerry Bruckheimer's speed dial.
Indeed. We should not say too much about that.
Why not?
Jerry is a remarkable person, and one of the reasons that I wanted to make that movie was there's an ignoble reason and there's a noble reason. The ignoble reason was that I thought I could duck and cover from the fallout from Love in the Time of Cholera. But the noble reason was that I thought there are only two types of movie I've never made. One's a Western and the other's a musical. I would dearly love to make both a Western and a musical. And that movie is partly a Western.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that it absolutely is it's a Jerry Bruckheimer movie. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, if you're in mass entertainment, and it's if you make films of any kind, it's stupid to think that you're not. You are in mass entertainment. Yeah. I mean, even the great European art movie makers are in mass entertainment in some form or another, and I'm sure they know it.
Yeah.
Then you can't turn aside from mass entertainment. If somebody's going to offer you the massiest mass entertainment, then do it. Find out what it feels like.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel very good.
Was it a different experience from Potter, where you're surrounded by people who've been working on the films previously?
But I also knew the world of Potter so well.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was English, because there was a very particular kind of sense of humour, and Joe Rowling is a most wonderful comic writer, and they were really the screenwriter. It's a guy called Steve Clovis, who's the most wonderful writer, and both wrote and directed a movie called The Fabulous Baker Boys, which is all about a terrible, tired, old lounge singing act.
Yeah.
And he was a great comedian as well. And so I knew that you could have tremendous fun with this this thing, which was about anarchy, really.
Yeah.
I always thought that what my story was about anarchy. It's about who's in charge. Are the teachers in charge or are the kids in charge? And I remember being at school and that was every day in almost every class, that was a question, you know?
Yeah.
You were constantly pushing the limits. And so, of course, that was a comedy and I was very familiar with it. I'd been to a school a bit, like they made a lot of fuss about, ooh, he's been to a school with sort of, you know, stone columns and all that kind of stuff.
But not floating candles and sausages that magically appear. No, absolutely not.
So I was very, very familiar with it, and I was familiar with what I wanted to do with Prince of Persia.
Yeah,
thank you. old. But Jerry had a slightly different idea. Jerry's rather a serious person, and I thought that it should be full of great high flung romance.
Yeah.
And Jerry, I'm not sure quite what it was. He's a clever guy.
Mm.
It's a bad mistake to think that anybody in Hollywood is stupid. They're absolutely not.
You don't stay at the top for 25 years without having
some
smarts.
You absolutely don't. They may be blinkered, but they are absolutely not stupid. And I never really did, because he found it difficult, I think, to express what wasn't there. And whatever it was not supplied by what I wanted. And I kept saying to him, but Jerry, come on, look at the shot. It's glorious, and there's the sun, and then there's the dune, and then there's the thorn tree. And he'd say, what story is it telling? And I said, well, damn, they've got to get from A to K. I mean, he said, no, they don't. The audience will not have the patience for them to get from A to K. You go from there to there. And what he did was he hired, I lost a couple of good friends over the editing of that movie, who were British editors, who were very fine men. You know, really, really talented people. But they weren't cutting the mustard for Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jerry brought in this guy, Michael Caine, who cuts for Spielberg.
Yeah.
And who therefore I now know, again, you know, it's I've had a fantastic run. I mean, the amount of pure enjoyment that I've had. I mean, I got to work alongside, even though I sort of resented him, but he's very eccentric. So you can't resent an eccentric. It's a difficult thing to do. And he works with the lights turned right down so you can say, what, can you see it, Michael? I can't see it. And the air conditioning racked right up. So you're shivering in the back. And the door is always locked. In order to get into the room where he's working, you have to knock.
Right.
And what you realise is that he is sort of an obsessive and he's an eccentric. And it was him that made the first 18 minutes of Private Ryan.
Oh, wow. Yeah. With
you know, where no shot's longer than that.
Mm. Yeah. Absolutely. No, he's a phenomenal editor. But I take it the Prince of Persia experience, has that put you off big-budget filmmaking?
I think if we were to be entirely frank and look the beast in the eye, it would say that it put big-budget filmmaking off me rather than me off big-budget filmmaking. No, it did okay.
Yeah.
It made, I don't know, 380 million or something like that,
mm-hmm.
which probably just a huge budget,
mm-hmm.
Just puts it into profit. Only just, but then those things, you know, because of television and the length of life of a movie is actually much longer than anybody thinks it is. You know, a movie can go on making money for 20 years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I still get checks from, you know, God knows, way back.
Must be quite a nice surprise now and again to get a nice...
Yeah, it is, because it does add up. What was the question?
Have you done with big-budget filmmaking? Because I know...
I think big-budget filmmaking has done with me for a bit.
Because you were flirting, weren't you? Or, I don't know whether you were actually attached, but you were linked with The Lone Ranger, which was another Bruckheimer film.
Everybody says that. I was never linked to The Lone Ranger.
Okay.
Because Jerry read the patterns in the sand.
Okay.
And said, I don't think so.
Okay.
I thought, and besides which, he knew exactly what I thought about it, because I thought that if Johnny was going to play Tonto, you weren't going to get a straight Tonto out of Johnny. You know, Johnny was going to be wild as Tonto.
Yeah.
I had also heard the notion that maybe Clooney would play the Lone Ranger.
Yes.
At which point it becomes one of the great comic pairings of life.
Yes.
And I thought how absolutely wonderful to have a stumblebum Lone Ranger who is constantly being swept up after by Tonto. That's yes. just funny.
Yes.
And I think I said to Jerry, God, that's what a wonderful pairing. In fact, I don't think they'd been to George Clooney.
Okay.
I'm not sure who's playing it.
It's Armie Hammer, who was in the social network.
See, that's radically different.
Yeah.
And I think that Jerry not only said, do I really want to go down any further down the line with this boy, but he also said, oh, I see, he sees it that way and I don't.
Yes.
Because
yes.
what he sees is that there, and I don't know how the movie will come out. Who's in charge? Who's directing it?
Gore Verbinski.
Oh, he's back with him.
Mm.
Okay. Huh.
And the first still from the film revealed Johnny Depp as Tonto in completely white face makeup with a dead bird on top of his head. So I don't think he's playing it entirely straight, as you might say. But you got one of the great straight Johnny Depp performances in Donnie Brasco, and indeed one of the great downplayed Al Pacino performances. How did you manage that? Because this is a man who is naturally exuberant. All his performances are very, very much
Johnny.
No, Pacino.
Pacino. Exuberant. There's a careful word. Well, I thought Al was... They were both wonderful. The last day, Al's last day, which was a very moving day, because he shot... Weirdly, he shot his last shot on his last day. No, he didn't. It was his last shot, and the last shot of Pacino in that movie is he knows he's going to be killed,
mm-hmm.
and he's going off because he believes in the rule of the organization to which he belongs, and if that organization says that he is to be killed, he will accept that judgment. He's never stood outside. He says at one point, I'm a spoke on the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
But what he does want to do is he wants the girl that he lives with, whom he's not particularly in love with, but she's a sweet woman, and he knows that, and she's kind to him, and she looks after him. Can't remember her character name. He wants her to know that he's gone, and he wants her to have whatever she can get out of him,
mm-hmm.
And so he leaves the car keys, and he leaves his watch, and I think he leaves his ring.
That's right, yeah.
And he puts them in this little cabinet, and he closes the drawer. And then he thinks she won't see that. You know, it could stay there for years. And so he opens the drawer so that she will at some point go, oh, what's that drawer doing open? And think, oh, that's his watch. And the key to the car, and she can sell the car, and he's looking after her. Johnny wasn't shooting that day, so he wasn't called. And suddenly there was Johnny on the side of the set.
Okay.
And he'd come in to see Al do the last shot of Lefty, of his character, which is a fantastic thing to do.
It's
a marvellous thing to do, and is a very full-hearted gesture. And when you meet Johnny, he's a sweet guy. He's the nicest man. But you wouldn't say that he was sort of Italian in his full-heartedness, but that was, in some way or another, was sort of an Italian gesture. And they loved one another, both of them. Al gave him, at the end, as everybody exchanges gifts, and the standard gift is the 25-year-old bottle of scotch. So 25-year-old bottle of scotch. You know, thanks very much, Al. It's lovely. But Johnny got this beautiful, beautiful guitar, because Al knew that he was a musician.
Yes.
And Al had gone to real trouble. So there was a sort of love affair between the two. Can I tell you how it happened?
Absolutely.
I was there when it happened. So very early on, they're riding around in a car. A lot of that movie takes place in cars. And the awful thing about cars in the movies is that once the actors are in there, they can't get out, because there are lights hanging and there are microphones, and you have to tape the doors up and all that kind of stuff. And then you, the director, with the camera, sits outside, probably on the bonnet of the car, and you look through the windscreen, and there are the actors, and you shoot them. But there's always a lot of faffing about. And we were sort of stopped, and the lighting was going, and the sound was going, suddenly, from inside the car, there came this huge, ripping fart. And I thought, what? And Johnny said, terribly sorry. And I said, no, it couldn't happen to anybody. No, please, please. And we went on, and people were still going, and in another couple of minutes' time, there was another huge fart. And Johnny said, I don't know what it is. I can't apologize to you. And Al said, and then there was a third.
Right.
And Johnny again protested. And at this time, Al went with a window. and then, at the fourth one, when Al was actually beginning to find this no longer something about which he could be humane, Johnny pulled out from under him the whoopee cushion that he was making. And Al thought that this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. He fell off his chair laughing. And then, of course, since they was going to be together in this car for yet another 2 hours, he was trying to do it himself, and he couldn't. He was hopeless of making farts with a whoopee cushion. And that was the beginning of the love affair. I can't remember the question.
I was just talking about how you got such, you know, a straight performance out of Johnny, a downplay performance out of Al.
Johnny does is, and you can absolutely see it in all the performances, Johnny needs a handhold, and the handhold will always be who is he going to imitate.
Yeah.
So in Pirates of the Caribbean, it's Keith Whatnot.
Keith Richards, yeah.
And for another performance, it'll be somebody else. And the side of Johnny that I loved most was Ed Wood.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to leave a British Airways, the first class compartment, of course, of a British Airways flight from Los Angeles at 35,000 feet. I was asked to leave because it was the middle of the night and I was making much too much noise watching Ed Wood. I thought it was fantastic. But Ed, you see the door shake. I think it looks very natural.
As long as you were just asked to move into another cabin and not asked to leave the plane entirely. But
yeah, I'm sure that must have been true. Yeah. But if Johnny can find somebody to imitate, then he'll be he's fine.
Yeah.
Himself, he's very mysterious.
Mm.
And there's a great performance to be got out of Johnny where what would it be like for Johnny to play, who was Freud's great sidekick? You can't hide. It would be very interesting to see Johnny do that, because he's a stupendous actor, and what he does is to imitate. And he found in that film, he found that the guy that he was playing, who was the FBI agent, who was still alive and who was around the movie, he found him. And I think one of the key things that Johnny latched onto and that gave that performance, it became what it was us asking this guy one day. We said, what frightens you? Because there was supposed to be a contract out on him.
Even at that time?
Mafia, yes. Wow. Mafia contract. Contracts never go away. He said, the contract doesn't frighten me anymore because they're all either in jail or dead. So I don't think there's anybody out there who's actually willing to go to the trouble of... But he said the 17-year-old kid with a cheap revolver who wants to get cred in a bar on a Saturday night and shoots me, that frightens me.
Mm.
And that's why he was absolutely rigid about disguise, and I never had a phone number for him. I always had to go through other people before I could get to him. And I think that sort of obsessive self-protection was something that gave Johnny that sort of mask that he had in that role. And I think as far as Al's concerned, it really amused Al that at the beginning of his career he has Michael Corleone, who is, I remember because I found these gangsters, I thought I can't make this, I can't rip off other people's movies for this, I can't be another chapter of of The Godfather.
Mm.
I actually have to go and see what's different about this. And so I wanted to get it documentarily accurate. And so I went out and I one way or another, I found a gang. And I used to go out on a Saturday with the gang, and I used to go and get drink with them and eat with them and go out in the evenings with them. And, hey, we bought you a present, Mikey. Oh, that's really nice of you. Where is this? It's there. Edge. Come on, Edge.
Do you still have the receipts?
No,
is there any way you can...
Sadly, no. Sadly not. I was very embarrassed by it, as with Edge. Edge didn't like the idea of this at all. But,
Because the story is, and it started with the Godfather, I think, and it went through Goodfellas and The Sopranos. It's that the mob kind of like being in movies, and they kind of like being around the world of movies. And
absolutely,
was that
right.
Something that you found?
Yes, they said to, one of them said to me, he said, we all like to think of ourselves as Michael, who is cold and far seeing and a general of great talent. We are in fact Sonny, who is we simply are high blood pressure fuck ups who can't stop ourselves from the sort of violence that's bred in us. And I thought that was very smart.
Indeed.
And they are like that. They are absolutely like that.
Do you stay in touch with them at all?
I've still got a phone number. No, I don't. you're better not.
Yeah.
There is always a comeback.
Yeah.
I had a phone call 3-4 years after, and somebody wanted something, and I was very quick to return the favor, because they run on favors, and if you don't, then nothing's going to happen, except you'll get a little bit jumpy until something does happen. And when it happens, it's probably not going to be very dramatic, but it's better to have a clean sheet with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, on a dramatic bombshell, Mike, I could talk to you all day long, but I think
I've had a lovely time.
It's been amazing. Thank you very much.
We have to let you go and finish Great Expectations.
Great Expectations.
So, absolutely. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Oh,
yeah, I knew there was something.
Yeah. Right.
Can I just ask one quick one on Great Expectations? You had a lovely
parallel for The Goblet of Fire being a kind of a North by Northwest
yes.
style thriller. Do you have a similar touch point for Great Expectations, no, or is it very much its own thing?
Not that
no.
exactly, but I did have a point of view that I thought was true about it, and from which the terrible... it's a terrible story. It's a story full of heartache and cruelty, and so that was very important to me. It was that the two people at the centre of the drama, who are Pip, the kid who is going to be a blacksmith and then suddenly is transmogrified into a gentleman, and Estella, that they are both abused children, and they're abused by the daft, distorting, distorted hopes of brutalized adults. So Miss Havisham is somebody who is horribly dumped at the altar and is desperate the whole of the rest of her life to shrink back from that and to make sure that it never happens to anybody again. And so she gets a little girl. She buys a little girl so that it should not happen to her. And that will be Miss Havisham's gift to the world. Horrible, distorted, twisted kind of thing. And the same is true of true of the boy. You know, Magwitch is put in jail and sent to Australia by the machinations of a bad gentleman. And so what he wants to do is to create the ultimate gentleman mm-hmm. who will take his revenge for him. That's simplistic, but... what's really interesting is that you get those links that go right the way down through the story from generation to generation, and I thought that was a tremendous thing to do, because both of the young people, Pip is then horrible in his own turn to the people who yeah. have his best interests at heart. He's horrible to the simple people at home. The girl is horrible to him, and so there's this terrible chain of blackness that, yeah. that spreads down through the story. That was my pattern for that.
Oh, fantastic! Well, I wish you all the best with it. And indeed, very much so. It's out next year, I believe, or later this year.
I would guess later this year. I think probably sort of November, something like that.
Just in time for Oscar season.
Oh. That list.
How you say that?
Wonderful, Mike chokes bullshit on his coffee. Moment in Hollywood when people have seen the film for the first time and they don't actually know what to say. Uh-huh. People's reactions after a screening are very... The best one I know, the most cynical, is marvellous, marvellous, must rush. but there's another one which... And the person creeps up to you and they say very softly in your ear, they say... Oscars. And it's never true.
Well, it's called Great Expectations, so we're hoping for the best, Mike. Okay. So, right. Indeed.
I've really enjoyed myself.
Likewise.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Mike Neal.